The way I ran into you is through LinkedIn, and I saw your profile, and your profile had the heading on the profile bio is incredible, man. And I think you have one of those stories and one of those experiences that not a lot of people get to experience, and I feel like I really want to hear your story, and I think a lot of people want to hear the story as well. So the headline, let me bring it up actually.
I think I've changed it since you
have you. but it was so good, man.
No, it's still good, but I just think I don't know, updated it.
Let's see.
It still says the same sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay, let's go. I think it's Mark Singer. There you go. Mark Singer Coaching. There you go. Happy days. All right. By the way, people can see the screen right now, which is great. I love that. It's like the Joe Rogan experience. See what Jamie is doing. You feel me? Here we go. So professional coach and motivational speaker with a different... Okay. But before the one before that, what was it? What
it did says, you sentenced to prison for a crime I hadn't committed, and given a life sentence with no release date. And in the process, I lost all my family whilst in prison. And now I'm a professional coach. And that's pretty much what it is. The only reason I've really updated that because I put motivational speaker in there now.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have that up there last time. Yeah. So I've just changed that really. So the rest of it's pretty much the same.
Yeah. Which is crazy. Yeah. Which is crazy. So let's start from the beginning, man. I feel like I wanna know the full story of Mark Singer and
how long you got.
As much as you can take as much as you want.
Well, I'm writing a book about it at the moment. So
what are you going to call the book, by the way?
Well, the working title is To Hell and Back and Then Some.
Ooh.
The story of Mark Singer. So that's the working title. Yeah. I mean, whether that gets changed before go public become published is debatable, right. But at the moment that's pretty much what I'm going to go with. I mean, the story really, I had a good upbringing, but I ended up in going off the rails when I was quite young, probably about 15. Got bullied at school, ended up getting into a football gang after school.
Where'd you grow up?
Watford.
Okay.
Yeah. And I got sort of drawn into that life where at the time, I thought it was cool. I wanted to make a name for myself, get a reputation, all of that sort of stuff, for the wrong reasons. I got involved with it. And it's a lot to do with not having some sort of attachment to a group or group of friends whilst at school, and also being bullied and wanting to stand up for yourself and have that protection.
Yeah.
I ended up getting dragged into that.
Okay.
But there's good points to it as well. But... yeah, anyway, I was involved in that for a long time, and I got in trouble with the police and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I eventually moved away from that life when I was about 25.
Mm. And
I
always had you stayed there for quite some time.
Well, I was involved in that scene for about 10 years.
Wow, from the age
of 15 to about 25.
Were there any things that you can share from that life? Like,
well, there's lots. I got in lots of trouble fighting football. And
so it was like a group of hooligans doing crazy stuff?
We used to call it a firm.
Right, okay.
And you've probably heard the casual scene. The casual scene is it's like a subculture.
Mm.
And if you watch the films like Football Factory, for instance, that's what that's about.
Yeah.
It's about that. And it's like the mods and the rockers were in the 60s.
Right.
It's not just about violence. It's
a brotherhood.
In fact, the violence is very small. It's minimal. It's more about the clothes. It's more about fashion. It's more about camaraderie, being in a gang, a group. It was all about that. Like I said with the mods and rockers, it was a lot about the clothes. You had fights and violence, but it was more about the scene. It was more about all of that sort of stuff.
Right.
It's very similar to what I was going through in that sense. And it was more like the 80s and the 90s. It was about the feeler and all of those sort of, Lacoste and outfits like that. But my time, it was more about Stone Island and stuff like that. So it was more about the clothes and stuff like that as well.
Right, okay.
So it was a scene. And it wasn't like what a lot of people think, like just rampaging thugs smashing people up and things. It wasn't. It's more about gangs. Like, you've got your own, you're engaging with your opposite number sort of thing.
Right.
So you've got people who are in the gangs in other teams.
Right.
And when they come to town or when you go to their town, you compete with each other.
Right.
And that's obviously where the violent side of it comes in. But that's essentially what the culture is about.
Yeah.
So you get sucked into that.
Right.
Especially when you're young, because you get It's cool. You think it's cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you look good. You feel good. Your confidence is good. And I never had that before. I didn't have that confidence. So I got that confidence from that. And I decided at an early age that I wanted to be like the main guy, or one of them anyway.
Okay. So you wanted to climb the ladder.
Yeah. And again, there's loads of films about it, which is. I decided I wanted to create this persona about who I am. And again, this is. When you look at what I do now as a coach and the psychological element of it, that was relevant. You could see that then, but I didn't realize it then because I basically created a persona for myself, which wasn't really who I am.
Okay.
Because I never had a fight at school. Yeah. I was never really violent at school. Yeah. I had a very happy upbringing, went to private school. Parents were both very loving. So there was no real aggression there as such. There was no real violence within me, but I created that side of me to fit in with the crowd.
Okay.
So I ended up getting, because I knew that to be respected within that crowd, you had to be a certain way, and act a certain way, and live a bit, come on. So I created that.
Yeah.
And when you look at the psychological side of that, that's part of the mindset. How you can create your mind, use your mindset to create whatever you want in life. In that circumstance, I created something quite negative.
Yeah.
But the flip side of it is you can create something quite amazing if you use it correctly.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And now, obviously, as I'm older, I'm doing trying to do something much more positive.
Absolutely.
But then I got into that. But I was working. I was always working. I mean, I was never not working. I worked in a family business, which was a leather goods retail business, which was a very successful business. Mm-hmm. We had shops in different stores right across the southeast, eight different stores. In like Harlequin and Bayswater and Thurrock Lakeside. So it was quite a busy, thriving business throughout the late 80s and early 90s.
Okay.
Probably late, right through the 90s actually, until the recession killed it. My father got quite ill with a brain abscess and nearly died. And that sort of led to the business sort of capitulating.
Right.
My mother and I tried to keep it going, but it wasn't working. The rates were too high. So we ended up closing the business and going different. My mother became a mortgage broker and I went into car sales.
Okay.
And so anyway, I'd moved away by now because I'd actually got banned from football for fighting.
Okay.
And I'd been in trouble with the police. And I'd gone to prison, but for a small thing, only for about 3 months.
Okay.
But, for a fight. And so I changed my life. I'd moved away from that. I'd met the girl who I thought I'd loved. Long story short, I'd started getting my life in order.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until some time later, a few years, good few years. I mean, I got into the club scene, started doing things like that, living a life. Again, it wasn't necessarily positive because I was involved in drugs and things like that.
Yeah.
But it was a different thing. There was no violence involved. It was a much more happier time.
Yeah. And you were there just to make the money.
Well, I was ecstasy and taking eaties and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I was going clubbing and stuff like
that. Okay, so you were taking the drugs.
I was taking them. I was selling them.
Yeah. that side hustle at that time.
But yeah, it was just part and parcel of what I was doing. So yeah. It all came down to creating a persona. Because, and this is why it's relevant all the way through, because, and this is all in my book, you see, because the journey that I've been on it's not a pleasant journey.
Yeah.
There's a lot of crap in there.
Yeah.
And it's not an easy read. It's not an easy write either, because there's a lot of stuff. I've been in prison a few times for stuff, which when you read that, you know, you might think, oh, hang on, he was put in prison for something he didn't do. I was.
Yeah.
But the way I justify that, because it's easy to, when you do get convicted of something you know you haven't done, it's easy to feel a victim. Mm. It's easy to say, I'm a victim of injustice.
Yeah.
But the reality is that I lived a life which was pretty negative for a long time.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Don't get me wrong, there was lots of positives as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like I was a horrible, nasty bully going around starting trouble with people. I wasn't. I had loads of friends. I was very popular. But I had a negative set of beliefs and attitudes, which didn't serve me well. And it used to lead me into lots of problems in life, trouble, obviously with the police and things like that. And it attracted the wrong sort of people into my life as well.
Let's start, like what? Like, give me examples of these sets of beliefs that you had, you lived your life by.
One of them would be that if you feel that someone's talking down to you, or not respecting you.
Right.
That would trigger something in me. Okay. That would trigger a belief that I had to stand up for myself and defend myself.
Right.
And that led me into two sets of trouble. You know, the thing I ended up getting convicted for, which I didn't do, but I also done something in the past which I did do, which I ended up in a fight with because someone stole my phone and there was pictures of my girlfriend on that phone. And when I confronted the guy over that, he basically told me to fuck off.
Right.
And I ended up hurting him quite badly and ended up going to prison for that.
Right.
And that was prior to this. And that is actually the precursor to what happened, because the reason I didn't get longer, because he started it, basically.
Right.
And when I got arrested for that, the police, he told a pack of lies. He made it out that I had attacked him for no reason.
Mm.
But however, when it came to court, he actually admitted that he started the fight.
Yeah.
And he also admitted that he'd stolen my phone. Yeah. So the police, in court, they found me not guilty of the charge.
Mm.
And they convicted me of a lesser charge, which didn't hold as much weight.
Right.
And I got only a couple of years.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until much later when I got in that dispute, let's say, because it wasn't even really a fight,
mm-hmm.
At the work Christmas party, which I ended up getting convicted for, that came back to bite me, because the reason I got convicted for that, stitched up basically, because I didn't do what they said I did at all, and I admit to it if I did, was because
the record
they had the arsehole that I'd got off with the last one.
Terrible.
I had the same prosecutor in court that from the previous one, which was how long, 7 years previously. They had no evidence on me whatsoever.
Yeah.
In fact, they did have evidence, but to prove that I got beaten up.
Yeah.
But they lost that. They had no forensics at all.
Yeah.
They had, it was four people against one, me. I got beaten up.
Okay.
My girlfriend was there. Her evidence got, they just called her a liar, basically.
Yeah.
And I was beaten up. I was in hospital for 2 weeks. My ribs broken. My face was like a balloon. I had my hand broken. I was in a terrible way. I was having blackouts for 2 weeks. The guy who I supposedly assaulted, A, said he didn't want anything to do with it. He refused to give a statement. And B, went to work the next morning.
Oh, wow. And then
the police made it sound like I tried to kill the guy.
Wow. Okay, so let me just recap quickly, because I feel like I want to... You told me a lot here. So you done a lot of...
You got to buy the book.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. It sounds like a good read, deep read. There's a lot of stuff in your experience. Yeah. So that 10 years led you... after that 10 years of... Did the guy who stole your phone, did that happen within the 10 years after?
That happened in the 10 years before, you mean? What do you mean? After
the 10 years like...
No, yeah. It was how long? Yeah, it was probably about... I'm trying to think how old I was. I was about 32. So about seven years later.
7 years later, crap happened. So this is the time where you were in the club scene, right?
Well, from the age of 25, I turned myself back on the football.
Okay.
Because I'd been involved in that from 15 to 25.
Yeah.
So obviously, I'd ended up in trouble. I got banned from football and I decided this wasn't for me anymore. Yeah. So I moved away.
Right.
And I started... getting involved in the club scene and finding new friends.
Right, and that's when this happened.
Well, it was sometime later.
Okay, sometime later that stuff happened.
Because I was involved in that scene for a while and it was probably about 6-7 years because I got my life sorted. I wasn't involved in any trouble. Apart from I was taking drugs and going out clubbing, but I wasn't involved in fighting and things like that.
How did you make your money back in the back then?
I was working. At that stage, I was selling cars.
Okay, and, you were a salesman, salesman.
I've always been, and also trained as a mortgage broker. Ironically, just before that, I mean, my mum was a mortgage broker and she wanted me to, she kept going on at me to, and this is before the crash.
Yeah.
And ironically, just before I got arrested for that thing, for the one where I had that fight, And I was guilty of that. It was bang out of order, and I set responsibility fully for that.
Yeah.
But I started training as a did my CMAPs and trained as a mortgage broker. For a year I did that, and then the arse fell out of the
2008, right? Yeah, everything went to crap.
And then I went to prison. So
crazy. So hold on. Let's recap quickly. So let's say so somewhere when you were 32, the crap with the guy who stole your phone happened.
Yeah.
Okay, you went to prison for about 3 months. You came out, and again,
one was longer. The one before was because I've been away a couple of times.
Okay.
So that was the football one was 3 months. That one was 2 years.
That one was 2 years. Yeah. So you done the full 2 years.
Yeah, because yeah.
How crazy was that?
Yeah. What the actual sentence?
Well, actually going to prison and doing all of that, because you're talking to a person here.
Do you know what? At that stage, I'll be honest with you. The first year of that sentence, I was glad to be there.
Because, please elaborate.
No, because my head was fucked, and I had a my girlfriend who I loved left me.
Oh,
because of all that, she stayed with me at first because after that fight, I went on the run for 6 months.
Okay,
I panicked.
You heard the guy.
My whole life fell to pieces.
Yeah,
and I couldn't work, couldn't do anything, and eventually I got caught. She stuck with me for a while, but the police found out somehow that she was still with me, and they started putting pressure on her family.
Damn.
And that led to us breaking up.
Yeah.
And I always still love that girl.
Yeah.
And she's the only girl the true love I've ever had.
Yeah.
And so that broke that relationship, and that led me to having a complete breakdown.
Yeah.
And by the time I ended up going to court and prison, I was just
shot
to pieces. Yeah. I mean, I just I was hated, and people were like I was public enemy number one, and
rock bottom.
Yeah, and I was really at the bay. So that first year in prison, I actually was just sorting my head out.
Yeah,
and trying to get myself back to some sort of normality. Really,
there's a lot of stories like that where people say in prison I had to sit down with myself. I had to put my thoughts in order and stuff like that.
The second year,
was
all about getting it back to normal.
Yeah,
I was working. I was feeling confident. I was getting back to normal, who I usually normally am.
Yeah.
Feeling much more myself. So by the time I got out, I was much more confident, happy, and all those sort of things.
And then what did you do right after you came out?
Well, work-wise and stuff.
Yeah, work-wise, where did you live? How did you live? All of that.
Well, I went back to my parents' house.
Right.
And live with them. And I just sort of, I'm trying to think what I was doing work-wise straight away. I did I work? I can't even remember, you know.
But you went back, you started working again, and you started picking up on your life again.
Yeah, I went back into the car trade again, I think, if I can remember rightly. I don't know if I did something before that, but anyway.
And then how long?
I did some currying. Yeah. I did some currying first. Okay. Oh, that's right. I went currying, and then I went travelling for a while.
Okay, that sounds positive.
To South, you know, Asia, and I started getting my life back in order.
Journey of finding yourself, sounds like. Yeah, exactly. Happy days, that sounds good. And then how long before, after that, and then this happens?
Well, that was not that many years later. It was about 4 years later.
Okay, what happened in those 4 years?
Nothing really. Nothing positive major. Stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I was working, I got a new girlfriend, I was still going out, like clubbing and things like that.
Yeah.
But I was nothing negative as such,
right?
Apart from taking drugs. I mean, I was still taking drugs.
Yeah. Before we get to the story, realized like why was I taking those drugs?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I mean, a lot of people like to stay taking drugs. It depends what drugs you're talking about as well. Ease, for instance. I don't have a negative view on them. Because especially in America now, they use them as to treat depression. So you know, cocaine on the other hand, it destroys lives.
Yeah, alcohol destroys lives.
Exactly. Any drug, anything you take too much destroys lives.
Yeah.
And I was doing coke as well,
mm-hmm.
and that was probably the worst thing for me. So it wasn't so much the clubbing, it wasn't so much the ecstasy. It was more about the coke.
Right.
That's the bane of my life. In those days, that was what changed my character, made me an arsehole.
Jeez, I could imagine. It
changed my whole... Because, like I said to you with the attitudes and beliefs, when you've developed a set of attitudes, and this is the thing, you see.
Mm.
When I came out of prison for that thing, I might have sorted my head out in a lot of ways, but one thing I never did is address the underlying attitudes and beliefs that led me to that situation in the first place. The belief that if someone's talking down to you, or you perceive that someone's talking down to you, then you have to react with aggression and show. And that all stems from back to when, and again, it all fits in with what I do now with the mindset.
Yeah.
The football belief, that was delivered because I developed a reputation. Everyone knew who I was by now. By the time I'd left that scene, everyone knew. And even to this day, people see me, and I hate it because they still see me as that person, a lot of people.
Right.
And you don't, I try and move away from that. But they, you know, you develop that belief that you're some sort of someone, some top boy or whatever.
Right.
And if someone's talking down to you, you think, who the hell are you talking to? That sort of mentality. And that then triggers that subconscious reaction where you think, you've got to respond with aggression in order to keep your not lose face, not lose your reputation, and show them that they can't push you around.
I see.
That all stems from when you're a kid, when I was first getting bullied at school.
Right.
So when you strip it all down.
But connected.
I hadn't done that. I didn't do that when I'd left prison. So I'd gone back out into society. In my mind, I was thinking, yeah, everything's great. I'm sorting my life out. Everything's good. I'm getting doing positive things. I'm getting a job. I've got a nice girlfriend. Well, she was all right. Yeah, sorting myself out. And then all of a sudden, I find myself in that situation. The reason I found my situation is because I was pushing myself so hard at work. I was working 7 days a week. I was working 12-hour days.
Mm.
I was doing really, really bloody well. I was earning a lot of money selling cars. I was earning like $5,000-$6,000 a month.
Ooh, happy days.
That. And because I was putting myself, but I was the number one salesman.
Yeah,
it was working for a big dealership.
Yeah,
and because I was number one, they had like a league table every month.
Yeah,
and I was always number one, and I wanted to stay there. And it comes down to reputation. thing.
I think that's what it is.
And it is, and you're pushing yourself, and it came down to the fact we had a Christmas work party.
Yeah,
and there was a hotel, and it had been booked, and my girlfriend had already gone to the hotel, and it was like 7 o'clock at night, and I was meant to meet her there.
Yeah.
And because I was pushing myself at work, I hadn't left work, and I was still trying to push a deal through, which I ended up losing anyway because I didn't hand it over in time or something like that.
Right.
And that annoyed me. But anyway, so that led to me feeling more stressed. So by the time I got to the party, I was just like stressed out.
Yeah.
And my energy was low. And when your energy is low, and this is what I do, this plays in again with what I do now as a coach, because I work with people's energy. When your energy is low, when you feel like a victim, when you feel conflict mindset, then what you do is you're only ever going to see things through certain prisms.
Right.
Limiting beliefs, fears, interpretations of situations, assumptions about what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the worst of the situation. And then what happened is that during that night, one of the young lads who was working in my branch, there was two branches there. This is what I should say. You had the St. Albans branch and you had Boreham Wood. St. Albans is a much bigger branch, and we'd mugged them off that year. They'd ended up 13 in the league table, and we'd ended up number one, and we were a much smaller branch.
Right.
I was the number one salesman, and they had about 10 salesmen. They didn't like us, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there was a lot of animosity there from their part, not us. And they'd been trying to start trouble all night long.
Yeah.
And we'd all turned up with our girlfriends. They had just blokes. Who'd been drinking all day, and none of us were really drinking. We were just eating. And but by about 1 o'clock, we'd all been drinking a bit.
Yeah.
But then one of the young lads who was working in as a mechanic there, he's 18. I wasn't there at the time when this happened. He got beaten up by four of these guys in the toilet.
Jeez.
And the police got called for it.
Yeah.
My girlfriend at the time was chatting with his girlfriend, only a young girl. Yeah. And she had an asthma attack. And my girlfriend rushed to help her. And in the process, turns on these guys and said, "You're bloody animals," or something like that.
Yeah.
And they basically turned on her and told her whatever. Someone come and told me about that. And I've gone to see what's happening. I've met my girlfriend and these other two, the one who got beaten up and his girlfriend outside the front of the hotel. By now, the police have been and gone.
Yeah.
So I've walked out and they said, "What's happened?" I've walked back into the hotel, into this like corridor. And as I've walked in, these four guys have confronted me.
Yeah.
And told me that I have to keep my missus on a leash and basically all sorts of abuse. And we had an argument and one thing led to another and then I ended up getting attacked by them.
Okay.
And I was wrestling with this one guy. It was probably, there's four of them, but the one, long story short, I got beaten up and blacked out.
Okay, so they were just raining punches from every angle.
Well, I got put down on the floor and I was kicked in the head.
They were being stomping on.
I think he got me in a headlock. And again, I passed out.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah.
He got me in a headlock and he was punching me like that with his hand and my nose burst and it was blood up the wall and everything.
Yeah, yeah,
my girlfriend came running and screaming. And again, I don't remember this. This is what I got told.
Yeah.
And she was screaming, thinking I was going to get killed.
Right.
And blood all up her dress. And then the police turned up. I was just being brought round.
Yeah.
And I got arrested. And I was the one who got arrested. And I couldn't understand why. I just couldn't fathom why, because I hadn't actually done anything. And so what they said is that I'd attacked them and I tried to cut one of their throats or something like that.
What? Did they find any weapon on you?
There was glasses around, but they didn't have anything on me.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said at the start, they had no forensics.
Right.
Nothing that indicates that I was doing anything. Right. I had glass. There was glasses, and I had a glass at the start, but I didn't use it to do anything like that.
Yeah.
But that's does here nor there. The fact is that they tried to say, yeah, he's come at me, and he's tried to do this, and he's done this, and he's done that. And it was just a load of lies.
Yeah.
And when it came to the court,
same prosecutor.
Well, before that even happened, I got interviewed because, like I said, I was in hospital for 2 weeks. They couldn't interview me for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So eventually, when they interviewed, my mum was phoning the police saying, "Look, we want them arrested. These other guys.
Yeah.
Because they've beaten him up.
Yeah.
The company did an internal investigation and they interviewed all of the people who were there that night, independently. What the police did is that they got these independent interviews, and by law, if someone says they don't want to take part in something, they can't force you, right? Well, they can subpoena you, but they can't force you to make a statement. So what they did is they used three of these independent statements from these females who worked for St. Albans and put them into this court bundle legally, unsigned, so that they could subpoena them to court to make their case look stronger.
Yeah.
Even though they had nothing really to say other than they just saw a fight.
Right.
And they didn't say anything about the details of the fight. They just said, yeah, we just saw a fight. That's all they said.
Yeah.
So, and then, anyway, so during the court case, my barrister stood up and said to them, oh, well, in your statement, you said so-and-so, so-and-so. And she said, well, I never made a statement. You did, because I've got it in my hands.
Yeah.
He goes, no, I definitely didn't. I refused to. So why have I got a statement in my hands then? And then she looked at it. She goes, well, it's not mine. And then he looked at it and there's no signature at the bottom. So what turned out happened is the police officer had faked those. He'd written them out himself, changed a few details to fit in with what was going on
in
the case and put them in there illegally. And it got found out. We tried to get the case thrown out.
Wow. And that's
crazy. The judge said was that... because it's already been heard, he's going to allow the case to continue, but he's going to instruct the jury to pretend they hadn't heard it.
What? What?
Which is unbelievable.
What is this?
Absolute nonsense.
What happened to that officer? What happened to that police guy?
This is it. The judge turned around. He got rid of the jury. He sent them all out. And he said, he got the copper up in court. And he said, this is disgraceful. I will not have this sort of behaviour. And this is absolutely atrocious, blah, blah, blah. I will be talking to your superior.
What?
That's all he said to him.
What? So you're telling me there are people like that still right now going around and they're putting people in prison?
I found out that copper, and this is the God's only truth, because one of the solicitors working on my case was an ex-copper. Yeah. She said that he'd been suspended twice for cocaine abuse.
Oh.
And that this was his last sort of chance.
Yeah.
And the reason why they were so determined to do me is because I had that reputation that I'd built up over the years, and because in the last instance when I'd gone to prison they felt that I didn't get long enough, they thought I should have got longer because I basically made them look stupid in court, because they tried to say that I'd done something I did do that assault, I admit that, but they said that I'd attacked him for no reason, and the guy admitted in court that he started the fight.
Yeah.
So they basically
played you, kind of. They had it for you.
This time around, if you look at the facts of the case, the actual facts of the case, there's no way you can understand why I was found guilty.
Yeah.
And the only reason I was found guilty, it wasn't because of the facts of the case. It was actually because of my previous.
Yeah, the record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because up to that point, I was going to walk out of court.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing there. Not only that, the four people whose evidence was against me, all of their statements didn't match.
Yeah.
One of them said I was wearing this, the other one said that, this one said this. Nothing matched. It was all inconsistent.
And then they said a life sentence? Is that what
it... Well, the thing is, the reason I got it was an IPP.
Okay.
And that means indeterminate public protection. Now, thankfully, that sentence has been completely outlawed now because it's inhumane.
Right.
I found... What it was actually brought out for sex offenders, believe it or not. It was years ago by David Blunkett in the 90s. And the reason what it was about is because if you'd have committed a serious offence at the time, sex offender, but it was rolled out for violent offences later, which was again repeated later on, a similar sort of offence, then they would give you what's called a public indeterminate public protection sentence.
Right.
Which means that you then have to prove to the parole board that you're no longer a threat to society before
and that could take forever.
It could take. How do you prove that you're never going to re-offend?
Yeah, how do you prove that? Be nice in prison.
Well, there's thousands of people, but the thing is, it doesn't matter. If you're, say you're depressed in prison, this is how it works, and you start taking antidepressants, they won't let you out because they'll say that you've got a mental health issue.
Jeez.
So they can't take a risk. So it's risk adverse. So they would not take any risk on letting anyone out at all. Yeah. And it only changed 2 years before I got out. They give you a tariff, which is your basic minimum that you've got to serve. But most people serve long over that. This guy, I went and coached a guy in prison last week who's doing an IPP. His tariff was 18 months. He's been in there 18 years.
Oh, my God.
So it destroys...
18 years.
Exactly. And do you know what his crime was?
Yeah.
Threatening phone call.
What?
Yeah, that's his crime.
Bro, this is crazy.
Exactly.
What kind of justice system is this, man?
Research it. It's the biggest fuck-up in this history of justice. And it only changed. See, a few things, bizarre things, went in my favour because I got a six-year tariff.
Yeah.
And like I said, in court, if you backtrack a little bit there, when I would have walked out of court, because you can tell if the jury are on your side or not. And they were, because they were looking over, smiling, nodding, and things like that. And then they brought out my previous information, stuff about me being in the football firm and that fight I had, which I went to prison for. And you could see then change, their demeanour changed, because they automatically put two and two together, come up with...
If
he's used violence before, he must be guilty of this one.
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, any normal person would probably think.
Yeah.
You know, if I was in that position, I probably would have thought the same.
Yeah, but the evidence is...
Exactly, but I mean, the evidence went out the window.
Yeah, when they saw that.
You know, this is why I was so confident going into the case, because I thought there is no evidence.
Yeah.
Because I didn't do it.
Yeah.
But it didn't work like that.
Right.
It worked because my previous was enough to convict me.
It caught up to you.
It was enough to convict me. So that's how I dealt with it when I actually went to prison.
Okay, so hold on. Yeah. So they gave you IPP.
So they gave me the IPP.
And then what was the minimum?
6 years.
6 years, Jesus Christ.
So that night, the day I got sentenced, Stephen, which ironically was the 11th at 11 a.m. How weird is that? Yeah, seriously.
11-11, that should be the title of the book.
It's crazy.
11-11-11.
And I do see 11-11s everywhere I look now. Yeah, it's going to be a positive thing. It means your life is changing.
Absolutely.
Anyway, you fucking did that day. But I got sent down and I'm sitting in the room downstairs in the court.
Yeah.
And my barrister come in and he said, "I'm sorry to tell you, Mark, but you're never getting out of prison."
Oh,
that's exactly
wow.
what he said to me. And I could have killed him. And I was just like, why didn't you, do you know, because I blamed him in a way because I felt that he didn't take it serious enough. I don't know. It wasn't really his fault, but I felt that he missed things. He should have said things and, you know, he didn't cross-examine this one the right way or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so I was fuming. And I know my mum ripped a strip out of him upstairs as well in the room or wherever they were. But at the time, what do you do when you've just been told you're never going to get out of prison for something you just haven't done?
Jesus Christ, I don't know, man.
What do you think? What goes through your mind?
Like, I don't know. What the fuck,
so,
bro?
I know, you know, you haven't done it. You just know. And there's no one. And obviously, people assume that you did do it.
Yeah.
But anyone who knows me, I'm an honest guy.
Yeah.
I'll admit if I've done something.
Yeah.
And there's no reason for me to lie. You know, it would have been easier actually not to be honest about it and just say, yeah, I've done it. And, you know, but it didn't. It doesn't work like that. But anyway, so I went to prison and everybody in there, friends, officers, everybody I spoke to, was saying the same thing. There's no point you getting any ideas of getting out because you're not. You know, that's it now.
That's terrible.
And a couple of friends I made who had similar sentences to me were the same mind. They were like, but my mindset was to crack on. And I knew that, this is what I said to you a minute ago, I took responsibility because I thought to myself, well, look, the reason I'm in this, I could have sat there for ages and blamed the world and thought, well, it's an injustice. But then I thought to myself, well, it's my fault I'm here. Because if it hadn't been for my attitudes, beliefs and stuff, I wouldn't have got involved in that situation and I wouldn't be here now.
Right.
So that's what led me to that situation. All right, I didn't have the fight, but I wouldn't have been in that situation in the first place if I had my head straight.
Yeah.
So I decided that I wanted to sort that out and I wanted to get my beliefs and attitudes right so that I would never find myself in that situation. And obviously I wanted to get out of prison.
Yeah.
But I started doing what they call the offending behaviour courses. And I one after the next. You have to do psychological assessment courses, drinking, alcohol, drug courses, violent, you know, aggression course, everything going.
And what was the outline of the course? What did you guys
learn?
There's
so many. There's about 30 different courses I've done.
Okay, so they were good. That's positive. That's very positive.
It's non-stop. And that's what they do. Every course you do, in theory, knocks down your risk.
Okay.
In prison. So the more you progress, but what actually does happen, and this is where it's counterproductive, is because every course you do, especially with an IPP, they find more things to work on.
Okay.
Well, you've done really well there, but this, and then they'll give you another course. So what happens is you end up with a never-ending stream of courses.
Yeah, 30 courses. Jesus.
Exactly. But I just smashed them out. I just thought, I'm going to throw myself into all of that.
Yeah.
And I was doing really well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was, you know, in myself, I mean, with changing my mentality, I was feeling better and happier about myself and everything else like that. I was training, I was doing exercise, you know, I was working in there and everything like that. And it was in first 2 years, I was at Swaleside at the time in Kent. That's when my mum happened. That's when suddenly my mum got ill. And Christmas 2013. And it was crazy. I mean, they changed the rules about clothes having been sent in just before, right, in November. And because they used to be able to get your normal clothes sent in.
Yeah.
But they changed the rules that you were no longer allowed to have normal clothes sent in.
Yeah.
So there was a cut-off date by the end of November to get new clothes sent in. So I was on the phone all the time trying to get my mum to get me some new clothes before this cut-off date. Little did I know that she had cancer. She was getting tired. She was looking, every time she was visiting me, she looked grey. And I knew something was wrong, but I didn't put it down to that. I just thought it was stress.
Right.
And all of a sudden, she collapsed, basically. I think it was the 8th of December. And she went to hospital for the tests. And it turned out she had cancer. And within 2 weeks, she was dead.
Wow.
And that was that. And it was, wow. And she was like my rock. She was the main person in my life. And so, yeah, I had to cope. It just turned my life upside down. And it was weird. I don't even know. You know, luckily, I was on a very good wing at the time. And the prison I was in is all long-term, as that was, Swaleside. It was all lifers, serious people.
Yeah. Nothing to lose.
But they were all great. I mean, I had every sort of demographic come to me, like, you know, the white guy, the black guys, the Muslims, whoever, everyone had their own, the travellers, everybody you could think of, all did their own thing. And they were all so respectful. Everyone came and helped in whatever way they could. And it made it much, much easier. And, but I had to arrange the funeral from there. Mm-hmm. I had to attend with this officer there at Christmas. And my dad went to pieces. He couldn't cope with it.
Yeah,
so I had to arrange everything myself. And I'm an only son. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I tried to keep... Well, I held it together to deal with it. Bloody hard. But mm-hmm. I did. Mm-hmm. And then they moved me to the Mount, which was closer to home, so that I could be closer to my father, because they knew that he was struggling. And
by himself now.
And so they moved me there. And they stuck me on the worst bloody wing they could have stuck me on at first, with in a two-man cell. All you hear is bloody rap music, bang, bang, bang every night, and doors kicking constantly. And I was there how long? My mum died on the 21st of December 2013. It was on the 22nd of March 2014 that I was on the phone to my dad in the morning. And he died. He just dropped down dead as I was talking to him from a cardiac arrest.
No way.
As I was talking to him on the phone. And
what were you guys talking about?
You won't believe it. Well, I phoned him in the morning. It was 11:30. And he was in a bad way. He'd been up to see me the week before. Some friends had brought him to see me. And he was skin and bones. And I was really worried about him. And he wasn't eating. He wasn't taking his medication. He had medication. One of the last things my mum said to me when she was dying was, make sure your father takes his medication. And right. He wasn't. So he just gave up, basically.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't doing anything. I had friends trying to help him, but he wasn't interested. Mm-hmm. And you were like, I mean, because we had 21 cats.
21 cats in the house?
Well, actually, tell a lie. There was 21 cats when I went to prison.
Okay.
By the time they died, my mum and dad, they were 74.
Whoa.
It just got completely out of control. But that's another story.
Whoa. Well, 74 cats in the house.
That completely went. It got. I'll be honest with you, my mum said to me when she went, before she died, obviously, one day, she said, because I was trying to get her to get them rehomed, and she said, look, I'm hoarding cats because they're replacing you.
Oh.
Being there, you know? So, yeah, but that's the difference. But anyway, the house is a complete pigsty because of all these cats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're going crazy in
so
there.
So my dad, obviously, and my mum, even when she was alive, couldn't keep up with it.
Yeah.
So obviously that added to the problems. And like I said, when he died, it was just like, wow.
Yeah. And what are you guys talking about? Were you like,
oh, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
I said on the phone to him, I phoned him and he couldn't speak. He couldn't hardly speak. He's like, yeah. Ma, I think I'm dying. He was saying something. He couldn't barely talk.
Yeah.
And I said, you can't die. Who's going to feed the cats? That's the last thing I said to him.
Yeah, and then he...
And he died.
May they rest in peace,
man. I've regretted that for a long time. I've beat myself up over saying that. Yeah. I was like, why didn't I say I loved you or something like that? You know?
I think you will. At some point you will, man. I think this is what I believe, yeah? Like outside of this, I believe that where humans are too complex and too great to disappear after death, there's something else.
I agree with
there's
you.
Something else.
I agree with that. I 100% agree. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, this is something I've not told many people, actually, because I've actually had a very strange experience around that, which is relevant.
Yeah.
My mum always used to tell me when I was a kid that when someone dies, a light bulb goes out or a light flashes, right?
Yeah.
I was in a cell in Swaleside. She died on a Saturday and the weather, 2 days later on the Monday, the weather was shit. It was like really bad. I'm laying in the cell, just the telly was on, but I weren't watching it. I was just sort of there. And I had one of these strip lights like here.
Yeah,
in the cell, and I'd been in that cell 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Not once had that light moved or changed or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting there and it just starts flickering, right? And I didn't notice it at first, and I was just sitting there, carried on sitting there, and then about 10 minutes later, 20 minutes later, it started flickering again.
Okay,
and it caught my attention, so I looked up and I just looked at it and I thought, okay, like that. And then I remembered what my mum had said to me, and I just said to the light, I said, if that's you, make it flick again, like that. And it did.
Wow.
Right? And that freaked me out. All the hairs on the back of my neck stood up, right?
Jesus, yeah.
So anyway, I waited. I thought, it's probably just a technical thing, right? It's probably just a problem. I thought, I'll report it in the morning.
Yeah.
No big deal. But then it started playing on my mind. So I thought, I got up and I thought, I'd leave it. I'm going to wait and see if it flickers on its own, right? I'm not going to say anything. It didn't. So I left it for 2 hours. And just before I was about to go to sleep, I'm standing there looking at it, and I said, okay, I said, if it is you, flick it once more now, and I will believe it's you. Instantly it flickered.
Wow.
And that's no word of a lie.
Jesus.
And I freaked out. I was like, but I felt you like complete euphoria.
Yeah.
Elated. So anyway, I went to bed. And I thought to myself, right, I'm just going to monitor this situation.
Yeah.
And I'm going to watch it for the next couple of days. Because if it carries on just flickering on its own, then there's a problem in there. It's just a light. Yeah. And it didn't. Never again.
Wow.
Never, ever again.
But that, it's probably that euphoric feeling really saved you a little bit.
That's the first night. That was on the Monday. That my mum died on the Saturday. That was on the Monday.
Yeah.
It's fast forward 3 months, right?
Yeah.
I'm now in a different prison.
Yeah.
In a different cell.
Yeah.
My dad's just died.
Mm-hmm.
He died on a Saturday.
Yeah.
This is now the Monday.
Yeah.
Guess what happened? Exact same thing again. In a different cell. I've been in that cell, 2 weeks? And not once had that light changed or flickered or anything like that. Sudden bang, same thing. Exact same thing.
They came to visit.
Freaked the bloody life out of me.
Yeah.
Only for one night. And I did the same thing. I monitored it again. Nothing. No change in that. So.
That's crazy.
It is crazy.
So what happened after? Okay, so your parents pass away, and then 3 months, and then you're still in that new prison close to home.
Well, I was there till I got out that one.
And then how long did you spend? Like in total, what was your full sentence?
6 years. I ended up getting.
You spent 6 years.
I got out on my tariff. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Well, ironically, and this is the crazy thing: how things happen in life. It was actually that whole trauma. Because I lost my, not just them, I lost in total in 1 year, I lost 31 people, animals and things that I loved.
Jeez.
I lost my grandfather. the girl I loved, who I said about before, she ran off with my... I weren't with her at the time. We'd split up. She was still my ex, but I still loved her. She was the only person left on the planet who I still loved. She went off with my best mate.
Right.
That's crazy. That broke me completely again.
Jesus, so you lost two people.
She broke my heart twice in my lifetime.
Jesus Christ. Person.
But, you know, how can someone, one person break someone's heart twice?
My God.
But, I mean, she did. Yeah. And so anyway.
So, yeah, let's be, all right. So what year did you come out? Or did
2000
you?
And, blah, blah, blah. When did I come out? 2017.
2017. All right. So let's speak about the first day until now. Let's talk about the redemption story.
Well, like I said to you, I mean, in a way, all of that helped me get out, because had I not dealt with all of that in such a positive way, I turned my life around, and I decided I didn't want to be a victim in prison.
Yeah.
And I decided I did a degree. I was mentoring young kids in there who were in gangs.
Okay.
And stuff like that. And it sort of demonstrated that I had turned my life around, and I was much more responsible, and I was doing the right things. And that's why they ended up letting me out.
Right.
Otherwise, I'd have never got out. Michael Gove changed the law 2 years before, which lowered the threshold so that you could now be given an opportunity to get out of prison. Otherwise, still being there now.
Yeah.
So anyway, as you just said.
So you, hold on. So let me recap quickly. In that 6 years, you got your degrees, you got the certificates, you started your coaching career.
The coaching career came when I got out.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So let's talk about the first day you come out, you leave prison.
Well, when I first come out, it done my head in completely.
You had nobody.
I had my aunt and my uncle, who I wasn't really close to.
Okay.
To be fair to them, I wasn't close to them before I went to prison, but to be fair to them, they helped me a lot.
Yeah.
They gave me somewhere to stay.
Yeah.
I stayed in there, like they had like a little annex, because otherwise I had nowhere to go.
Mm.
I had no home, nothing. And so they gave me somewhere to stay, because part of the release rules is I had to stay somewhere trusted for 3 months.
Mm.
It was either that or going to a hostel, and I really didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And so luckily they gave me somewhere to stay. And they gave me a lot of support after my mum and dad died. They were visiting me and stuff like that, sending me money if I needed it or things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So they helped me in a lot of ways. And we became closer over time, and, you know, that helped. So that was one good thing that came out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But as I got out, I just felt lost, because I had no job, no direction. Everything I ever knew had moved on. All my friends had either married, got kids, and I sort of got sucked into the old lifestyle a little bit.
Yeah.
But I knew that's not what I wanted.
Yeah.
And I felt that, you know, I just felt depressed.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I didn't know where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
I felt physically messed up, because I'd taken an overdose in prison not long before, after I found out about my ex going with my best friend. And I was still recovering from that. Because that physically done me in a lot. And so, yeah, I was sort of really trying to rebuild. So I just got back into that sort of crappy life mindset again, where I wasn't really moving forward with my life.
Yeah.
And I started going to have counselling, and also Reiki healing, and also coaching.
Okay.
And it was when I started having the coaching that I sort of realised that this is for me. Because before that, in prison, I'd done a business course, which they asked you to pick out a career. And I just said, out of the blue, life coaching, as a joke.
Yeah.
Part of that is I had to research it. And I realised that the skills and aptitudes to be a great coach, I had.
Yeah.
And so when I went out of coaching on the out, when I got out, it was about a year after being out, I realised that this was something I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be good at it. So I was going to I thought to myself, well, I'll go online. I researched it, obviously. And there was loads and loads of different diplomas and things like that you could get.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all about 1,500 quid.
Right.
And I thought, I'll do one of those. And then the woman I was seeing coaching me said to me, look, if you're going to do it properly. Go to the best. So it'll cost you a few quid, but do the best. So I thought, you know what, all right. So I found the best school I could find in the world.
Yeah.
And that was the Institute of Professional Excellence in Coaching, IPEC. I found them on the International Coaching Federation website, and I enrolled with them, not having a clue what I was doing. It was a complete act of faith. And I just thought, you know what, I'm on my ass. My life's going nowhere. Sod it.
Yeah.
I'm going to go for it. And I did. And it was the best thing I ever did in my life.
That sounds amazing. And how long ever since that?
That was in 2018. So it was about a year after I got out of prison. And a year later, I graduated.
Happy days. That's a redemption story right there. And then okay, so let's move on to the professional life now. So yeah. What type of clients are you getting and how do you help them?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, my niche has evolved as I've gone along. Because at first I had no clue who I was working with.
Yeah.
But I'm working a lot now with people who identify with me, who identify with what I've been through in some way. Mm. Not necessarily the prison and all of that sort of stuff, but my background.
Yeah, hard life.
You know, I haven't had a hard life as such. I had a good life, but I mean, but more of just a normal everyday guy.
Yeah.
Because that's what people see me as. There's no bullshit for me. There's no pretense.
Right.
I say it as it is. I just act like it is. And I think there's a, and I know this is true from talking to a lot of people, there's a stigma around coaches that they're like, it's airy fairy. Hey, man, like all that sort of stuff. you know, and especially in America. In England, it's not as much like that. But there is that stigma, and it puts a lot of people off. Because people think if you're going to go to a coach, it's going to be all about spiritual stuff and all of that, you know, and it's not. You get coaches like that, and they're the crack coaches, be honest with you.
Yeah.
I'm not like that. I'm straight. There's no BS for me. I'm just normal. And I get a lot of people who are attracted. There's no political correctness nonsense. It's just me as I am. And I get probably the demographic I work with is now men in their 40s, really.
Okay.
That's the main core I'm getting. And the one common thing that I get with people is that I'm down to earth. They feel that they can trust me. There's no patronizing with me. There's no judgment with me. So if they've done drugs, if they've lived this lifestyle, I'm not going to sit there and sneer down my nose at them.
Yeah, I've done all that shit.
Yeah, exactly. And they look at that and they say, well, he's been there, seen it, done it.
Yeah.
But the experience is key, you see. Yeah. And I had a conversation, funny enough, with another coach yesterday about this. It's about how there's so many young coaches out there who may be very well qualified, but they've got no life experience.
Yes.
And that's so important.
Yes. See, that's very important. That's very important.
It's massively important.
Like seeing someone like you said, someone who basically, for the lack of better term, fucked up his life, but then brought it back together.
Yeah, I've been through the ups and downs.
Yeah, go through the hell and back.
This is why the book's called To Hell and Back There and Then Some.
And then some, yeah.
Because it's been like that. It's like a roller coaster.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No one can... There is not no more valuable experience that you can give to like a life coach. I fucked up there, but I came back up. But then I fucked up there, I came back up. I've seen it all.
Yeah. And so now... And it's in the recent months... Well, recent weeks, I should even say, I've been getting an influx of clients, all very much the same in terms of, I mean, pretty much between the ages of 30 and 55, I'd say.
Mm.
So it's a mixture of ages, but all pretty much in the same sort of category.
What's their main problem? Why are they kind of like...
Most people, well, again, I mean, it's people who have reached a point, and I try and highlight this with people. If you've reached a turning point in your life where something's not working.
Yeah.
You know that something's not working. It's not necessarily people who are depressed. And this is another thing that people get wrong about coaching. They assume it's for people who are on their arse. They assume it's for people who are suicidal or whatever. Mm. It really isn't. It's for people who may be doing really well in their life. You know, you might have a great job. And my last two clients highlight that. Both of them are doing really well at work.
Mm.
They've got great lives.
Mm.
But they're not happy.
Something's not working,
and they want to improve their life and they want to become better.
Yeah,
that's the difference. They're not depressed. They're not suicidal. They're doing really well, but they want to be better people. Yeah. They want to get to grips with their life so that they can control their own happiness and feelings and confidence and be fulfilled.
Yeah,
and that's what I work with. So I help people who are doing good, doing all right, or you know, and who just want to be doing the best they can possibly. Yeah.
And how do you approach each client? Like, let's say, like a default setup where here I come. I'm Sammy. I'm a business owner. Right. I'm busy 7 days a week. Yeah. Personal life non-existent almost. You know what I mean? And a little bit of a bit of sugar addiction. I would take that. I'll admit that.
Well, we're all addicted to something.
Yeah, we're all addicted to something, right? And then let's say let's give him, what else should we give him? So that's true. Yeah. But let's say I have an alcohol addiction, let's say, which is not true, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, that's my client tomorrow's got that. So.
There you go. So, and then I'm looking to hit that next step in my life where I put a balance in my life.
Yeah.
So how would you approach my case?
What I do is I work a structured process.
Yeah.
So I don't tailor it for different people. That's not true in a sense, but I do tailor it. Obviously, everyone's got their own individual things, but the process I work is the same for everybody.
Yeah.
Because I work at what's called a core energy coaching process, which is unique to the Institute of Professional Excellence and Coaching. Mm-hmm. Only they teach that.
Right.
And it's different from a lot of what other coaches do.
Right.
Because a lot of coaches out there, and this is again what people don't really understand the difference in, because a lot of coaches out there, it's like A to B. You could come to me and say, right, Mark, I want to get a new job. Okay, so what do we need to do to find you that new job?
Right.
This is what we're going to do. And we work out a strategy. That's all they'll do. I won't do that. I work holistically. So I look under the surface. I look at the underlying causes, beliefs, attitudes, thoughts, everything that's going on to identify exactly why you want a new job, what's really going on. And I work with the core of yourself. So I look at there's six core areas to all of our lives, mentally, emotionally, environmentally, physically, spiritually, and socially.
Mm.
Did I miss anything? No. And if one or more of those areas is not functioning optimally for you, what happens is your energy plummets. You feel like shit all the time. And then you don't produce, your thoughts reflect how you're feeling. So, they create how you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're feeling shit, your energy is low, guess what? You're going to be thinking through the prism of either I'm a victim, or I'm angry or frustrated.
Mm.
You're not going to be feeling happy. So what happens then is you create those feelings. Your feelings create your actions.
Yeah.
And your actions go nowhere. They're counterproductive when you feel like my own story, which I related to. When you're thinking your attitudes and beliefs are negative or not positive, what happens? You have a breakdown of some sort. Something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Things don't turn out the way you want to. So what I do now is the opposite of what I did when I was younger. I help you optimize your energy so that you're always performing, thinking and performing at your best.
Yes.
So creating the thoughts that you want, your feelings that you want, and your actions that you want. Right. So that's how it works. And you're actually always consistently performing at your best. So it's not about one issue. It's not about just kicking drugs or alcohol or getting a new job. It's a holistic thing.
Yeah.
So it works right across the board in every area of your life.
Yes, so that's very important.
I don't just coach one area of your life. I coach everything.
Yeah.
So you come out away with a brand new blueprint, philosophy and way of being, which you can follow and live by every single day, which works every single day, consistently, every single day.
Happy days.
That's what I live by now. So don't get me wrong. There's days when I get pissed off. There's days when I'm feeling shit or whatever. But I know how to get myself out of that now.
Right.
I know what I'm aware enough to know when that's what I'm thinking creates how I'm feeling and so on, and how I can switch that.
Yeah.
And the way I do that is because we work with, it's part of the process I use. We make the intangible tangible.
Mm.
So all of the thoughts and feelings and, beliefs, attitudes, everything you've got in your mind, everything you feel and think, or everything during a day, a normal day, comes through. We categorize into levels, so 1 to 7. So, for instance, if you're feeling low, that would be a victim mentality. If you're feeling angry, that's level 2, that's a conflict. And what that does, it makes the intangible, such as our thoughts and feelings, tangible. Mm. So that we can then choose what we want to be thinking and feeling. So if you can identify at any given moment how you're feeling, you can then choose, and you can also identify what you're thinking.
Yeah.
So most of the time, we're not aware of what we're actually thinking because our subconscious is doing that. So if I ask you now, what are you telling yourself about this situation? You'd be like, what the fuck? I don't know.
Yeah.
But when you're aware of that, you can actually think, well, you know what? When you actually give it some real thought and reflect upon it, you're going to say, well, actually, I'm telling myself that I'm fearful of making a fool of myself or something like that, just use that example. And then you can change that thought to something that actually suits you and works for you. Yeah. That then in turn creates how you feel about a situation. You can change everything.
And it reflects your actions.
So and that's how I coach my clients, because I work with them to embed this philosophy over a period of months. So it's not like I work just one session here and there.
Yeah.
I work a philosophy period over 3-4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we work that is I start off with an attitudinal assessment. And that attitudinal assessment, firstly, it explains the difference between catabolic and anabolic energy. Catabolic being the draining, tearing down energy that we all have when we feel shit. So our energy just plummets. That's categorized by level 1 and 2 energy, victim and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Anabolic is a more building up, constructive energy. And that's categorized by the next 5 levels I work with, which are defined by responsibility, opportunity, joy, caring, and passion. So all the good things that you want to feel in life.
Yeah.
So we can actually choose. So we can choose, become, when we're aware of the concept of these two things, we can actually alter them and change them.
Yeah.
But again, when you walk into this process, it's all wow. I don't. What's all this about? This is why I have to do it a step by step process.
Right.
So you learn it.
And how long does it take for one person kind of like to start seeing changes? And how long do you recommend the period that they should stay with you until they can, you know, take on their lives?
Well,
by themselves?
Give a money back guarantee.
Yeah.
That if a client hasn't seen dramatic changes to their thinking and feelings after 1 month of working with me, then they get their full refund.
Yeah. That's confidence right there.
That's because it works.
Yeah.
As long as the client is committed to doing the work, of course, because yes. I can take the horse to the water, but I can't make it drink. If you, you just don't do it, then you're not going to do it.
Yeah, that's true. You got to be,
Which is why I have a very rigorous process when I start with a client, because when I interview, I start with a discovery call, which is 20 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll ask them a series of questions just to find out what their need and timing is. So the need, everyone's need is there, otherwise you wouldn't be on the call to me. But the timing might not be, the money might not be right. You might not have the money yet, or you might not have the time to commit to it.
Yeah.
You might think, a lot of people assume that you're just going to tell them all the answers.
No, it's not about work. That. Yeah,
you've got to put
some
work in.
Absolutely.
You have to do the work here.
And that's real. That's real. That makes the program, that's why it works, because, you know, like you have to put in the work. And you're being real about it. And I bet you a lot of coaches out there don't want to say that.
No, it's true.
Like, it's up to you.
Yeah, a lot of coaches would just, I mean, I did it at the start. I'll be honest with you. When I first started, I took the first person to come along and I wasn't, they weren't as committed as they should. They got a lot out of it, don't get me wrong,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't as committed as they should. And I felt like I had to chase them all the time to make them commit. And I don't like that. I want them to be 100% on it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm very diligent with that now with my clients. Now, I won't take a client if I don't feel that they're committed. I'll tell them to go away and come back to me when they are.
Yeah.
And so I'm very, very on it now.
Happy days, happy days. Yeah. I mean, let's. I think we should leave it at that, because I really. I think we've covered pretty much a lot. If a person wants to
long life story,
That's beautiful, man. I think we can do another session with this. I really think that we're just peeling off the first layer. I think there's a lot more stories, a lot more life experiences in there. Like, I wanted to ask you about the first day in prison and that, but that's for the next session. You know what I mean?
Four of them.
Absolutely. So if people want to get in touch with you, what's the fastest way to get in touch with you? How can they find you?
Yeah, I mean, you can put it, I'm on everything. I do a live weekly show on my Facebook as well, which is every Wednesday at 7:30.
Mm-hmm.
You can get me on there. But obviously, you can catch me anywhere, really. You can email me directly or my website. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. I'm on LinkedIn.
There you go.
I'm on everything. But you can book a discovery. If you go onto Instagram, there's a little thing, what's that, Linktree thing?
Yeah.
Everything is on there.
Okay.
And you can clock it, you can read all my articles that I write for a magazine as well. I'm writing a book. Everything I've done is on there. And you can also book a discovery call with me, which is only a half hour session. So
happy days. Ladies and gentlemen, all the information is in the description. Mark, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate you. I really appreciate the energy, and I wish you all the best in the world. And we'll do the next one very soon. Best of luck.
No worries.